This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
City Limits.
Brought to us by the People's Committee for Melbourne every Wednesday at 9am.
City Limits is Melbourne's only hour devoted to our urban environment.
To transport and planning and housing issues.
To privatisations and our utility services.
To building and or maintaining a sense of community. 855 on the AM band, if we can hear it through the noise and find it through the smog.
City Limits.
Here we are, City Limits, and it's a fourth Wednesday of the month, and I'm here, I'm Kevin Healy, and Anne Maxwell's over there, she's Anne Maxwell.
I continue to be.
Yes. And today we're going to be talking in the second half of the program to community activist Helen Vandenberg about water.
Oh, yes.
We're following up an interesting program that was on Big Ideas, actually, at the ABC a few weeks ago.
Okay.
Where they had a number of people involved in the program, but they pointed out that in New Zealand, water is regarded as a person legally and has to be treated as such. And Helen tells me it's much the same here. So we're going to discuss that aspect
Wonderful.
Of water. Yeah, that you have to treat it so you can't abuse it, because if you abuse it, you're abusing effectively a person. So
personhood in the law. Yeah, that gives you legal rights, doesn't it?
It does indeed. So we're going to go into all those details with Helen today. So that's the second half of the program. And first, of course, more importantly, a cup of tea.
Oh, yes. Get the tea going.
Yes, that's right. We've got to get the tea. This is the same one that was in the packet from 2 weeks ago, because I bought the tin in last week. So this is the same. This is the Chinese green that you had 2 weeks ago.
Oh,
well, not
good.
The same, because it's you had it 2 weeks ago, but this is the same tea leaves, sort of, if you follow my meaning.
Well, I'm always impressed that it's loose leaf over there, Kevin. That doesn't get better than that.
Now, you've got a choice of olive green or white with sort of various colours of red spots on it.
Dots. Let's go dots.
You're going the spots. Okay.
Yeah,
there
you.
We are. Okay. That's
A nice colour.
Have a sip. There we are. That's the tea taken care of. Now, I've got some, I realised with my glasses out on my head. It's okay. I think it's pretty upsetting, I think, when unfortunately people take actions that can upset his sense of true blue Aussie values for poor Tony Abbott.
His sensibility is offended, is it?
Yes, poor Tony. He's just come back from that conference that conservative conference that people were at overseas. Mm-hmm. He was also at that conference. I think he spoke.
They're all taking jaunts overseas.
And he probably spoke very well there, I would have thought.
I imagine.
But he's very upset this week because, Gray, Sir Gray, Sir whatever his name was, Gray, he was a British, and he was Sir George Gray was his name.
Hmm.
He was the colonial era state governor in South Australia, and one of the biggest seats in the country, size-wise.
Right.
Gray is named after him. And this week, the electoral people have decided to change the name to, wait for it, it's awful, it's an awful thought, O'Donoghue.
Hmm?
Yeah, O'Donoghue, after Lawitja O'Donoghue, the Indigenous activist.
Mm-hmm.
And Tony's very, very upset indeed. now, this bloke, Gray, was obviously heavily involved in displacing the Indigenous people in South Australia, no doubt. As the colonial era governor, and he's being replaced by an Indigenous person in the name. Now, Tony says, well, it's another example of, and this I think is something we'd all agree with, of the green left official establishment trying to change the way we think about ourselves without first seeking meaningful input from the Australian public.
Oh, he's complaining about yes. the meaningful input.
By meaningful input from the Australian public, I presume he means himself.
Yes.
And he says, how far is this going to extend? Which is a good question, isn't it? I mean, how far can you go in these issues? I mean, and is the Electoral Commission trying to cancel our 18th and 19th century history? Oh, my God, it gets worse and worse, doesn't it? So,
poor guy's feathers are ruffled, aren't they?
I think perhaps people should get behind Tony and get it back to Gray and get the Indigenous name off the bloody thing.
That's right. That's yeah. that. There's something to mobilise around. Well,
the member for Gray, who's also a Liberal, agrees with Tony, by the way.
Yeah,
I won't give him his comments, but okay. there you are.
Yeah. Divided nation, here we come.
Yeah, speaking of divided nation, the Herald Sun on Monday reported the speech that that Pauline gave in London at the weekend.
Oh, yes.
Now, most of the reports talked about the fact that it was a half-empty room.
Okay.
And no one really listened much and, had some critical comment about it. The Herald Sun story... Hmm. Not England anymore, Pauline's right, quote Farage. And the story starts, Reform UK leader Nigel Farage applauded Pauline Hanson's attack on multiculturalism in Britain after she declared she felt like she was in a different country when visiting parts of London. And it just goes on with all praise for her speech and him. It's an incredible, there's no criticism, no mention that there was hardly anyone in the room, no mention of that at all. And... you know, she goes to places in Australia, you see the full burqa. I went to Tower Hamlets last week, this is for our Pauline, and wasn't it a rude awakening? I felt I was in another country. And then the article itself says, the Herald Sun visited Tower Hamlets on the weekend while an afternoon market was running. Dozens of stallholders were selling cut-price items, including clothing, jewellery, home... Many women wore burqas as they congregated in large groups and few could be heard speaking English. Many stall signs in the main area of the borough were not in English and there was a noticeable mix of ethnic groups frequenting the area. Senator Hanson has repeatedly called for banning the burqa, etc. It's an extraordinary article in that it doesn't mention any of the criticisms all the rest of the media raised over that particular issue. It's just
she could almost have handed them the article.
Probably did. Yeah. So there you are.
Diversity of opinion coming out. Not. You know, speaking of those half-empty rooms at those conservative conferences, I remember seeing, do you remember the Yes Men, who are this activist group doing stuff? And they got, they were able to present at the Davos conference, I think it was, one time. And I've watched the video of it, and their presentation was how to use, because we're running out of food and we've got so many people, how to introduce cannibalism into the food chain. So I'm doing this whole PowerPoint and this presentation, and you look at the audience and it's a half empty room and they're all half asleep and they don't even realise what's being said.
Anyway, no, that's right. They're probably all candidates for the first meal.
We would hope.
Now, I think page 34 of the Financial Review last Friday has to get full marks for alerting us to the tragedies that's happening in the economy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Now, firstly, because there's a threatened strike at the Pilbara at BHP, which, as we know, BHP stands for bloody huge profits, bloody huge polluter, take your pick, or both. But the Pilbara has been union free for ages, but with the new labour industrial relations laws, the unions are there now moving in and the industry is really upset about it. Tania Constable is the chief executive of the Minerals Council, and she is the one who authorises all those ads about how wonderful the minerals are doing for Australia and all the taxes they pay.
That's right, paying for our schooling, how we need, and our health, yes.
Yeah, how we need more renewable gas and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, Tani has written a very thoughtful think piece, and she actually, well, just in a very inter alia, Labor's regressive industrial relations reforms, and she puts reforms in parentheses because you know what they're, in 2022, risk spreading, wait for this, poisonous CFMEU-style unionism across the entire economy.
Oh.
Like red-hot lava, it's spreading from the Pilbara right across the country. The economy is stuffed. Stuffed poisoned. Poisoned.
The barbarians are at the gates.
Yes. And in the course of trying to sort of water it down a bit, Albanese called for the unions not to abuse the privileges they've been given. Now, we know that workers are so privileged in our society, as we well know.
Mm.
But the Financial Review editorial next door to the article by Tania, they run side by side. The headline is PM's Workplace Laws Lit Industrial Tinderbox in Mines.
Mm.
But here's the really key bit. You know, lining up with Tania's taking over the entire economy. It's hypocritical. This is what Albanese's comment was, hypocritical, given that he has given them the keys to the iron ore kingdom. The unions are in complete control. Like, forget Santos, forget Woodside, forget Gina, forget Twitty, forget Tania. The unions own the lot. They've took the keys.
It all happened so fast, Kevin. Yes. I just wasn't awake.
Yes.
Oh, Lordy, imagine a world where the unions were in control.
Yes, they've got the keys. Isn't that terrible?
Keys to the kingdom.
Yeah, but while they've got the keys, Aldi had the money, unfortunately. But poor Aldi, which, when it came to Australia, refused to even allow unions to walk in the door, it's got to pay $55 million to thousands of warehouse workers because of underpayment.
Ooh, yeah. Never.
And it claimed that it was significantly inflated, the actual amount, $10 million originally claimed, but then they discovered it's actually $55
million. Wow.
Mainly because they demanded that workers start 15 minutes early before their actual time and finish later without getting any overtime and getting paid for those times. So you add it all up over a long period and guess what? $55 million.
Mm.
Poor old Aldi. Yeah.
Oh, well, how else do you get low prices except for exploiting your workers?
Exploiting the workers. Now, there's an article, I should almost read the lot, because there was a terrific article in The Age a couple of weeks ago. A lot of people would have read it, of course, called Privatisation, the Hidden Driver of Our Inflation Scourge.
Mm.
And it really gets stuck into privatisation.
Yay. Which paper was this in?
This is in The Age a couple
them.
Of weeks ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Missed that one. Yeah.
So why is privatisation to blame? Well, let's look at what's driving price increases. The fastest rising costs in the CPI basket over the past two decades have been utilities, gas, I won't go into the figures, but gas, medical and hospital insurance, schools and childcare, preschool and primary, water and sewerage, housing. Mm. Other items have fallen. Electronics, household appliances, clothing and footwear have got much cheaper courtesy of the Chinese manufacturing boom. Mm. Every single item eating away at household budget was once a public good made available by government for free or at affordable rates. Or it's a privatised service operating alongside struggling universal public options like schools and Medicare. Big inflation shocks are, of course, triggered by major events, but what makes that contagion amplify is the fact that we've handed the provision of essential services to for-profit actors. Yeah. When an energy price shock hits, firms scramble to protect profit margins by lifting fees, and with little transparent competition, why wouldn't they? And it goes on along those lines. Consider the scope of what has changed. There were the huge sell-offs in the 90s, Qantas, Telstra, the Commonwealth Employment Service, prisons and more. Then add in the explosion in government-funded human services contracted to for-profit providers since the 2010s in vocational education and training, schools, healthcare, childcare, disability care and aged care. There are thousands of disparate businesses like GPs, NDIS firms, colleges and private hospitals whose aggregated profits seeking activity raises prices. Selling off assets or sharing establishment costs for new services with business made government balance sheets look better in the short run, but we're paying dearly for it now. And it goes on and on.
Who wrote that?
That was a woman called Alison Pennington, who's chief economist at the McGill Institute, which is hardly a Marxist-Leninist body, but
she's spot on with that.
Nonetheless.
Though.
She concludes saying that public ownership and control should be prioritised in energy where exposure to global supply shocks is most painful by establishing new Commonwealth entity to build, own and deliver cheap renewable energy, the et cetera, et cetera. But,
Can I just point out something there, Kevin? Which is the non-common sense idea that if a government spends, it can actually drive down inflation. So everyone always says, oh, the government's spending too much, they're driving up inflation. No. If the government was to spend more on healthcare and on education and on what else do we have there?
Oh, energy heaps of things, and all that health stuff. And everything else,
all that stuff. If you turn it back into provision of the public option through government spending, you're actually going to, reduce that cost of living basket. So we all should be behind the federal government spending more.
Right. Okay. Well, that's right. And of course, when they talk about it too, they don't take into account what you're not spending or what they're not spending anymore, on, hopefully, on some of those consultancies.
That's right.
Although they're still spending far too much on them as well. But they should be spending nothing on them, in my opinion.
Well,
but,
turning that privatisation ship around is going to be a long haul because they've basically, as they say, they've lost all the knowledge in the public service for running these things. But it can
well,
be done.
Well, the public transport system here in Victoria is a classic example where, in fact, the public still owns the system and still owns the infrastructure, still owns the trains and trams, but we rent it to the private owner. But it, you know, if you rent a house, you pay the owner of the house rent. But in this case, we rent it to them, but pay them
we
to
pay
rent an
them.
Office. Yeah, I mean it's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's never worked. I have never heard a good thing about privatisation. Anyway, that's good. That sometimes
well,
a little article slips in
there. You obviously
in there.
Weren't listening to Jeff Kennett and and Paul Keating and everyone else when they privatised things.
One of the biggest protests I ever went to, Kevin.
Well, one of the classic examples was, in fact, Qantas, because when the government privatised Qantas, the argument was it didn't have the public money to upgrade the number of planes, the new planes and everything else it needed to keep competitive.
Eh?
Couldn't find the money.
Oh, tragedy.
And so the efficiency of the private sector came into account. but then sometime later when Qantas was privatised and the government talked about bringing new airlines in on the American route, it was from the Middle East, some of the Middle East airlines coming in, Qantas complained that this was unfair advantage because these other airlines were owned by the government and had an unfair advantage over them.
So do they want competition or do they not want competition?
So apparently in that case, the ownership by the government was a benefit to the airline. So
it created a more efficient airline.
Yes,
who would have thought that?
A bit hard to follow their logic, I found, but anyway, that's how it goes.
If they're looking for money, can you just run down to the Treasury and I'm sure they'll find some for you.
Now, there's also an interesting study by the Australia Institute that 61% of Australians think the government school system needs more funding. Surprise, surprise.
Okay.
I mean, what happened to the other, 61, the other 49 or whatever it is? No, 39. almost 40% of respondents said they would send their children to a local public school if there were more funding, according to a nationwide representative. The belief government schools did not have enough funding was shared across party lines. 51% of One Nation voters, 53% of coalitions. Such the polling showed 52% thought private schools were overfunded. Well, they are. Every dollar they get's overfunding. This was the belief among 60% of Labor, but because there's been some suggestion they might even cut funding to the private schools. So the private schools, you'll be surprised to hear, are pooling their political power in an effort to future-proof funding and lock in support for the independent sector. And they tell us what a great job they do for the whole community, actually. But they also point out where the most private schools are, and would you believe they happen to be in some of the better class electorates, you would
Never.
Think. Goldstein And the Kooyong in Melbourne is the highest number. But they're very upset that the government might cut funding when they should, in fact,
cut the 100%, in my opinion.
Yes.
Absolutely 100%.
Yes, they should be raising the money from their parents if they're so keen.
Yeah. Another interesting article by Ross Gittins the other week saying if productivity can't be measured, how on earth can we improve it? And he makes the point that, you know, the economists all say we have to improve kind of productivity. They've got the Productivity Commission doing all this stuff. But he makes a number of key points, but he says productivity is a concept, a perfectly sensible concept, but it's not directly observable. You can't see it and touch it, meaning you can't measure it directly. And he goes on to say, ultimately, he then quotes a person called Omani, who wrote a partner in Deloitte Access, who wrote a piece about it. He said, concluded his report with a challenge for decision makers. Ultimately, he wrote, economic policy should aim to maximise societal well-being, not simply measured productivity. In a mature, high-income economy like Australia, success may increasingly be defined not by how fast we grow, but by what we choose to value.
Mm-hmm.
And he points out that some of the things measured for productivity, this is what Gittins points out, don't take into account things like health and other things that, you know, that that may well impact on it. So
sounds like a measurement or something you would care about as a target if you were an investor, not if you're a citizen looking for services.
No, but I think it means workers have to work a little harder, that's all.
Okay. Yeah.
And they don't, do they?
Clearly, I mean, they should be starting 15 minutes earlier.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, but, and poor old KPMG is still having a lot of trouble. It's appointed a new CEO overnight, though, so everything should be okay.
All right.
Yeah.
We'll be back on track.
Yeah, back on track.
Not doing any insider trading.
And, of course, they always say that this is... This is not our values. I think what they mean by this is not our values is where our values are. We don't want to get caught. And having got sprung, well, yeah. Speaking of getting caught, this is terrible. Zoran Mamdani, the New York mayor, who's quite left in certainly
terrible
in American politics, he's left, and he's trying to work out whether. Because apparently Benjamin Netanyahu's coming to the UN General Assembly in September.
Okay.
And he's trying to work out whether he has the power to arrest him and pack him off to the International Criminal Court. I don't think he has, but anyway, it's interesting concept.
Can you just imagine there would be a gunfight between the New York authorities and the federal?
That's right. ICE people running up and down. Anyway, they could take Mandami away. So that's a bit of a danger. But the Israeli ambassador to the UN called. He wants Mamdani arrested now. He says instead of focusing on his responsibilities as mayor, the rising wave of anti-Semitism in his city, he has chosen to incite hostility and generate headlines by attacking the state of Israel. It will not change things. Prime Minister Netanyahu will come to New York, address the UN with pride and stand before the world to state Israel's truth and its unwavering right to defend its citizens. If anyone should be arrested, it's Mamdani. So there you are.
Interesting that he is poking his nose into the international stuff, because doesn't that signal that presidential aspiration?
It well might.
I wonder if I'll live long enough to see that.
Who knows? I mean, we've got another several terms of Trump, haven't we? If Trump gets his way.
That's right. If he gets his way. Well, I'll drink my good tea. That might help me live long enough.
Speaking of Trump, he's very upset because some American soldiers got killed. He doesn't realise that if you're in war and you're killing other people, there's a rough chance they might try to kill you back.
Right.
Which many of those young people who sign up for the military, I think, don't recognise either. They want to go out and kill people, but they don't sort of figure the bit.
Nobody explained that to him, that bit.
Yeah. So once a couple of soldiers were killed, he said that now we're going to get even worse. We're going to really make them pay for this, having killed many, many Iranis in the last few weeks. But once they killed an American... It's worse. We've got to get them more because that's the same attitude that Israel takes, of course, isn't it?
A little bit lopsided.
Yeah, a little, just a touch. Just a touch. Yeah, and there was also a photo published a couple of weeks ago. You can see it, a bloke being tortured. The photo shows a blindfolded man lying prone on a folded, fold-out cot, naked except for underpants, hands zipped tight behind his back, cord lashed around his body. What appears to be a broomstick slipped through a length of square metal pipe, tying him down to the cot. In Hebrew, a caption says, "Good morning." When the photo was posted on social media, it showed at least one war crime being committed and perhaps two, human rights groups said. Who the man is and where he was remain unclear. The image circulated widely online after it was reposted by a Palestinian activist who wrote that an Israeli soldier first posted it and had since deleted his account. But then, of course, Israel comes out and says the incident did not align with the military's values and regulations. Well, one assumes, again, the values and regulations are don't publish the photo, don't put the photo online and let people see what we do to people.
That value about not getting caught, eh?
Yes, so that's something of a worry too, I would have thought.
Yeah, when things slip through the cracks like that.
And we'll go to Helen in a moment, but also the customers for Australian coal, and we still export heaps and heaps of coal, even though we're, of course, committed to net zero. Net zero doesn't, of course, mean zero. It means we offset them with trees in Bali or something.
Palm trees.
Yeah, but our customers in Asia are saying, look, they want a reassessment of how coal is priced, and they think they should be paying a lot less than they're paying now to us for our coal. But let's hope they don't win, because I think it's great that we're sending coal overseas and polluting the whole world, particularly on top of all the gas we send as well.
We don't have to count that in our emissions,
though,
do we?
Well, no, you don't. That's scope three. You don't count that. You don't count that locally. And interestingly, in America, there's massive backlash against data centres in places, mainly because of it's putting up their electricity and water prices, they suddenly realise, and of course using it as well, but that's beside the point. But the figures have turned around dramatically in the last 6 months or so, with a massive majority now across the even across the political divide who totally oppose the idea of the data centres in their area. It's 66%. Are opposed to building large data centres, and 75% Democrats, 60% Republicans. So,
yet again, a bipartisan issue.
Yes, yes, yes. So
that wouldn't be behind the drive to come to Australia, would it?
Well, the good news for them, of course, is for the data centre people, is that we're encouraging it at an enormous rate.
Aren't we? 162 of them so far,
yeah,
I heard.
That's right. We're vying desperately to get hold of the bloody things. So there we are. Anyway, look, well, speaking of such things and water, we'll talk about water after this break, because we're going to get Helen Vandenberg on the line, and away we go.
Okay. Okay, let's have a listen to Dr. Yunga Pingu. Thank you.
Okay, we've got Helen Vandenberg on the line. And Helen, I mentioned earlier in the program that was on the ABC a few weeks ago about water, and talking about water being having a right of its own, and in New Zealand, and you tell me the same thing applies here. Can you give us some detail about what this is all about?
Well, it's not quite the same as New Zealand. They gave it personhood,
yep,
which was what Wurundjeri wanted in the Yarra Act, but was not granted. With the government chose the living entity definition. And but in essence, it is saying that water is central to life. Water, and it's a movement towards recognising that the right of a river to exist as a river, to act as a river. Now, I think you put it in the context of what's going on globally through the Earth Centre law reforms, which is an international movement looking at the rights of nature, and this has come down to looking at the rights of rivers. And what traditional custodians have always understood is that water is fundamental to life, and it needs to be respected. And in that culture where country is alive, so landscape and water are alive, and you are grateful for what it gives you and therefore respectful and responsible, and so you only take what you need and you think of future generations, that whole custodianship and respect for nature and an understanding that we live within nature, we are part of it, and dependent upon it. That concept's really a bit of a struggle for a materialistic, capitalistic culture to come to terms with, but at least we've made a start. So the Yarra Act declared the Birrarungs, rather, as a living entity. But the strategic plan only protected 300 metres either side of it for a certain area, and it completely missed the tributaries. When we campaigned through the Rivers of the West community campaign at the end of 2017 and 18, we argued that a river is a living connected entity and that it is the river actually is from the source, the multiple sources, to the sea. For instance, there for the Maribyrnong, we have 24 named creeks that are tributaries. They are all part of the living entity of the Maribyrnong, and that is recognised in the waterways of the West. So in the Waterways of the West Action Plan. As a consequence of that, there has been changes to the planning schemes, and significant landscape overlays were introduced. Now, that is the first step on in starting to protect a river, right, or a creek or a particular reach within it. But first of all, you've got to, when planners are now looking at a planning permit, they have to consider the whole river, not just the bit of the creek that's in front of them in, or adjacent to this particular allotment. They also have to consider somewhere else where it's draining into and what the impact will be on that there and downstream, right?
Yep.
So it's making people, it's making planners take more consideration of what the impact will be. Now, when it comes down to it, what does it mean in cold, hard facts? Well, the most recent example we've had was there's a development on 22 Steel Court in Tullamarine for a huge number of warehouses. And originally that development was reluctant to even give 14 metres away from the creek. But by the time they got to VCAT, by the time they were getting through the process, the law had changed. The significant landscape overlays came in along Steel Creek. And that requires you to consider, now it's not mandated, unfortunately, but you have to consider a 50-metre buffer and nothing less than 30, right? When we got to, and Brimbank Council did a wonderful job of defending the 50-metre buffer, pointing out that for the creek to be healthy, we needed to have a properly vegetated riparian area there. And there's plenty of signs to show that the riparian zone, we've got that, this is the transition from water to land or land to water where the vegetation plays a critical role in the health of the river. So what finished up in VCAT was that they mandated, because the laws changed while this thing was in process, by the time you get to VCAT, the law is what is the law of the day. So VCAT upheld a 30-metre buffer, not a 50-metre, which is disappointing, but at least we got the 30. The other thing is, if a river is alive, would you poison it? Of course not. So the other part of this is what's going to be done to reduce pollution to the waterways of the West, which have taken a huge burden of pollution, particularly through industrial times when Victoria got quite wealthy on its industry and the West got dirty air, dirty jobs, poor health and putrid rivers.
So I assume, Helen, that in time, if governments and VCAT and everyone else observe this new situation, we'll see our waterways cleaned up pretty much.
Well, that's the intention. I mean, the reason the waterways are in a mess is largely because of planning and the impact of road runoff. And EPA is doing a better job on, well, it's starting to do a better job on cracking down on industry, but it's just small people who don't bother to put bunding around their pits to prevent spills going into waterways. That's still a huge problem. Ultimately, in time, it should give us better quality water. It should give us healthier rivers, which means there would be more fish and river, more fish and frogs. A river needs to flow in its own way. Now, we've gone and rocked and concreted the edges so they don't move, right, because rivers have a habit of moving. In the last 40 years, we've lost about 2 metres of bank along the Maribyrnong between Canning Street and the confluence of Steel Creek, because Friends of the Maribyrnong Valley planted along that trail, and the trees that were 2 metres from the edge, from the water's edge, are now at the water's edge. So it just shows you how the river keeps carving its way through. Plus, you've got boats going up there at the wrong speed, causing wake. That doesn't help either. Mm. But anyhow, ultimately, it is going to lead, provided we continue to improve the rules. But the thing that we most need to get people to understand is it's not just a backdrop to our living. It's the centre of life, really. I mean, how long can you live without water? Now, these rivers and creeks in the West, once upon a time you could just walk up and drink them. You couldn't do that today. So there's a long road to recovery, but it's possible to start planning it, and it's possible to start saying to everybody, you've got to think of what's coming off your roof and off your road is going to the river. So I think there's an obligation here for all road authorities to consider how they can start putting in toxicant treatment systems, simple things, retrofit your stormwater pits so that they filter the water as it goes through. You have activated carbon at the bottom of it, you take out the chemicals. Now, it was interesting. We had a Maribyrnong collaboration meeting recently, and I met a particular engineer from a council that I actually like. And I said to him and asked him what he was doing, and I said, oh, so you will be planning if you're doing upgrades of your stormwater infrastructure, putting toxicant treatment systems. Explain what I meant. And he kind of looked at me like, no, we're not doing that. However, Uncle Dave was at that meeting, and Uncle Dave spoke about what the living entity concept is, how they wanted personhood for rivers, and how, you know, water and the land and the water are inextricably mixed, and what we do on land is affecting the river, and what happens to the river affects the land. And he was speaking about it in great detail. And at the end of the collaboration that day, the same engineer came up to me and said, "Well, Helen, when you spoke to me this morning, I had no idea what you would." It kind of startled me. He said, "But after listening to Dave now, I have an understanding of living entity. And although I can't change what I've got to do tomorrow or in the next few weeks, I can now advocate for that up the chain." Right? So that gave me a bit of hope.
Yeah, well, on a similar note, Helen, a bloke called Victor Stephenson, who's a land management practitioner, Aboriginal person, of course, He's just published a book called The Knowledge. I don't know if you're aware of it or not.
No, I haven't. But he says, did a lot of work on fire.
Yes, that's right. Well, it's mainly about fire, but he talks about the crucial role played by old-growth trees in maintaining a balanced ecosystem, and says that... The authorities need to recognise and value the depth of experience and knowledge that underpins caring for country. So it's a similar thing, isn't it?
Oh, it is absolutely true. And, I mean, there's the whole of country plan around. Each traditional owner group, traditional custodian group, because then I don't know why people call them owners, because that's not part of their culture. They don't own. They live in relationship with country. That whole custodianship is what we need to learn, and we need to understand it as high-grade science, if you want to put a Western interpretation on it. I mean, the value of those old trees, if you think of the mycelium network they'd have in the soil to keep the trees healthy and the soil healthy, it's phenomenal. And they have understood all that connection. I mean, over 66,000 years, you can build up an incredible amount of knowledge and observation. And it's also gone through climate changes.
And in 230, you can also lose a hell of a lot of it, unfortunately, yeah.
Well, we have, but it is possible to start on a path of restoration, which is what we are determined to do for the Maribyrnong catchment. Because we will all be better off if the river is better off. If we understand that every drop of water is precious for a start, particularly fresh water, which is such a small portion of the water on this planet. I mean, water distinguishes our planet. And water gives life. And when you think of the food web that is in a river, it's extraordinary. Tiny, the unseen creatures that we don't know about, which we've had a project of quilting where we've been chatting with Angela Clark from Maribyrnong River and Waterways Association, has been meeting with a whole lot of embroidery groups and quilting groups in our catchment. And it starts with exposing them to these unseen creatures and photos of them and how they live and how extraordinary they are and how they're the basis for the food web in an aquatic system, right? And we haven't even named all of the ones in Australia yet. And these unseen creatures can prevent blue-green algae from occurring. They can eat up the eggs of the carp in phenomenal numbers. They really play a dynamic role, and yet most of us don't even know about them. Anyhow, so from that food web, you go up to your macroinvertebrates and, you know, who depends upon those, the platypus, birds eat them. You've got people eat the yabbies and the fish. It is a wonderful system in there, but I think a lot of people just think the river is a bit of water running through. They're not aware of how much life is in the river and how much water, how much more life there could be. I mean, if you can catch a big fish in the Maribyrnong, you're pretty much sure that it was one of the ones that we released, because we had, 300,000 young fish released into the system a few years back while we were on the little jetty with Danny Pearson releasing these baby fish into the water. They don't breed in the Maribyrnong very well because it's too polluted and we don't have the woody habitat in there. So if the river is alive, it's got to have all its attributes in the water. So we need that in-stream wood. We need the right vegetation where it drops its leaves and into the water at a pace where the water, where it can rot away in the water and these unseen creatures can help break it up as well. You've got to have your trees controlling the temperature, and you've got to have space for the floodwaters. And that's the big problem with planning, because planners have allowed villages, cities to be built on floodplains. And that's going to be a huge problem with sea level rise.
And that, but I mean, also that near the river leads to presumably polluting type runoffs into the water anyway.
Well, it does. But look, Kevin, every problem that we have in the Maribyrnong has got a response we can make. It just needs funding, right? And it needs to. We need to pick up the pace on what we're doing if we're going to really protect the rivers and hand on something at least a bit decent to future generations, which is our moral obligation, right? And besides that, the EPA Act requires everybody not to pollute and to consider future generations in the decisions you make. So we have to get on with this. Now, you can hold back stormwater quite successfully. You can do it with talking tanks. Do you know what they are?
No.
Good, right. Well, what they do is, for instance, if it's a new development, you can mandate that all roof water runs into tanks, and these are connected electronically so that you know how full they are. When there's a storm coming, when there's a storm predicted to be coming, you release that water in the tanks slowly so that during the storm event, they fill up. And then that water can be released into the nearby waterways when the river flow is low. Now, that's being done to protect platypus in a creek on the eastern side of Melbourne, right? But there's no reason why you couldn't do that in all these new, you know, there's going to be a new development at Clarkfield, Riddles Creek. So these are places where you can do it. You can also mandate that the roof water be plumbed into so that people use it for their laundry and their toilets. You can, there are plenty of things that can be done. You can also have leaky tanks in the ground so that you're replenishing groundwater, right? Because we've covered over so much of the land, the groundwater is not getting recharged. And in fact, in the western part of Melbourne, in the Maribyrnong and the Werribee catchment, the groundwater has not recovered from the millennium drought. The level is still low. Now, our creeks in the west all rely on groundwater to flow in from October to April or May, depending on how dry it is. Now, with less water, less groundwater, they're coming down to a trickle in summer. So there are, you can put toxic treatment systems into your stormwater pits to help clean up your water. You can slow the flow. You can get out there and do lots of revegetation along the riverbanks to improve the biodiversity of the area. You can get people to be a little more careful with the water they use and perhaps not expect to have long showers every day. Does your skin really need it? Are you that dirty? Or, you know, would a few showers less in a week help? I mean, we've lost 25% of our rainfall in the west. In the next 2065, we could have lost another 20 to 40%, depending on how bad climate change gets. So the water's not going to come out of the sky. So where are you going to get your drinking water from? Well, look, we all use the sewer system. These wastewater treatment plants have huge volumes of wastewater, of recycled water, at the end of the process. Now, that recycled water can be further improved. You can either bring it up to a level where it is compatible with the water quality in the rivers and it can support the life of the river, and you can use it for environmental flows, which is, that's just basically giving the river enough water to keep flowing, by the way. It's not some extreme measure or some crackpot solution. I mean, the river's got to be able to flow. And most of our rivers are hungry for water at the moment. I mean, there are 325 gigalitres missing from our rivers that they are now need to be healthy. And the sustainable water strategy, which has absolutely stalled on this, is supposed to be finding 100 gigalitres by 2032. And the only water corporation that's done anything about that is Greater Western Water, about reducing their take from rivers. They've got a plan, but they haven't got the money to do it yet. Anyhow, I've lost the track of where I was going. There's just so much that can be done. And that recycled water at the waste treatment plants, you could be using that for drinking water. I mean, if you've been to London and drunk the water there, you have recycled water. Obviously, it doesn't kill people. It's been doing it for years. So why is it that we can't be sensible here and say, rather than trying to store huge amounts of recycled water, and then when I've run out of storage space, oh, I've got to release it into the river, and that's not good in its current state because it's still got pharmaceuticals and things in it. Why can't we just improve those plants so that they're producing either drinking water or water that's good for the river? We do both, preferably. However, as I said, the government's got to pick up its pace, improve its investments, and understand that water is going to be a huge controversial issue. We are not getting it out of the sky. We've got to make the best use of every drop we've got, and we need to keep the rivers alive. That is our obligation to future generations. And besides that, going to a lovely, healthy river and sitting at the side of it, or going fishing there, or bird watching, or swimming in it when it gets clean enough to be able to do it, that is what a river is for. And we've lost it. We have campaigns to say, make our rivers swimmable. We've gone so far down the industrial, it's a drain attitude, and now we're reversing. But we need to go quicker than we're doing it, because otherwise the rivers are not going to be even flowing at all, because we're not going to get much water in the future from the sky. But we're going to get it in such bucket loads that it's going to come as a dramatic episode rather than...
Let's hope. And look, can I take you just to one other area? Up in the Northern Territory, the Beetaloo Gas Pump, which is about to start working and fracking up there, and the Northern Territory seem to be approving all sorts of proposals up there that depend on saying that virtually the arterial basin water is almost bottomless and endless, but it isn't, is it? I mean,
of course it's not. I mean, it's taken millions and millions and millions of years for an artesian basin to form, right? We haven't got any extra water on the planet from when we originally got water on the planet, right? And it took us what? Water is extraordinary, and it's here, and I mean, even the groundwater supplies have changed so much. It's changed the wobble. It's made the earth wobble a bit more because there's been so much of it being depleted in parts of the globe. The groundwater and the artesian basins are critical, and they are life-giving to the centre. And if you pollute that, it's just criminal to pollute that water. And for instance, what fracking is doing is another outrageous assault on waterways, and it's an assault on the future. I mean, it is so unsustainable. When you pollute your water, you're basically reducing life capacity on the planet.
Go on. I was thinking, in terms of polluting up there, that is the new law about treating it as an entity, is that nationwide or just statewide?
Oh, no. Victoria's the only place that's done it. not a nation. I mean, the Concerned Waterways Alliance is a group of, what, 13 or 14 of groups of us got together, and we were extremely concerned about the state of the rivers that flow off the southern side of the Great Divide. Everybody's obsessed with the Murray-Darling Basin. Huge problem, needs a lot of work. The plan has been subverted and destroyed, and they're trying to redo it. But when we write submissions from the CWA, we are saying at a national level we need to adopt this concept of the living entity. And then once you recognise it as a living entity, how do you protect it? How do you conserve it? How do you restore its health? It needs to be a national obsession, really, a national commitment. At the moment, we haven't got that. We have got it in Victoria. And look, if people can't get their head around the living entity part of it, so long as they get their head around the fact that water is critical for life and we need to have it clean and we need to protect it and let it be a river, which means it's got to have space to flood out, small floods, big floods, and hopefully people get out of the way so that there's no damage done. So it's got to be a national concern, yeah, but we're not there yet. I mean, that's where the Andrews government in 2017, when they brought in the Birrarung Act, I'm sorry, I can't remember the whole name of the act, was a real pace setter. But successive government, I mean, these planning controls are further proof that they're slowly getting on with the job, but it's far too slow. It's lost a lot of momentum, particularly since the last election. I mean, just prior to the last election, the government announced that they would make the significant landscape overlays on the Maribyrnong and the Werribee, the lower Maribyrnong and Werribee, permanent, and then they spent all that time bringing significant landscape overlays on the tributaries and a few other creeks on the other side of Melbourne that are tributaries to the Yarra. But it could go a lot quicker. And as I said, there's going to be investment needed for upgrading of treatment plants so we can either reuse the water for drinking water or for environmental flows. I mean, no one likes being thirsty, and nobody seems to think, and people just don't know that our rivers are so over-extracted that they're struggling to survive. And I mean, I've often said, the reach of Steel Creek behind, I've watched my creek die in this particular section. It had yabbies, huge populations of...
Helen, we've got only a few seconds left, by the way, so just...
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Well, I'll stop.
But, look, thanks for that, and we'll no doubt keep in touch on it, but thanks for giving us your time and your incredible knowledge on the subject. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kevin, and bye, Anne.
Bye-bye, Helen.
Thanks. Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Helen. Helen Vandenberg bye. There, who... I think you people can tell is a wonderful knowledge of this issue, and we'll keep following up on it.
Yeah, she reminds us of how important it all is. You know, it is life. It is the source of life.
Exactly. Yeah. All right, so next week we're going to be talking to Dave Sweeney about sending off uranium to India and AUKUS and all sorts of things like that.
Oh, that'll be interesting, yeah. All right, we will be back this time next Wednesday, and stay with us now on 3CR Community Radio for Anarchist World this
week. And thanks for keeping us on air so wonderfully.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.